Let me go ahead and get started with the session. I apologize for being 5 minutes late getting this started, and it's a pre-publication session dealing with a forthcoming book, Scattering the Saints, Schism Within Mormonism. And we have a very interesting and diverse panel of people that are involved in this session. I should introduce myself. My name is Newell Bringhurst. I'm a retired professor of history and political science from College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. And the members of this panel, and I guess I'll just give you a little bit of the idea of the format of this session. There are four of us that are members of this panel. Besides myself, John Hamer, who you see out there passing out the flyers describing the book that we're going to be publishing. Actually, it's going to be published next month. We're just in the process of doing the final editing and the graphics and everything else. And so the book is virtually complete, and it's going to be a bargain price. It's a $19 paperback, $19.95 paperback. And so John is going to talk a little bit about the contents of the volume itself. And he'll be talking about the various essays. So you can use that as a guide when he's up here talking. He's going to be showing some graphics concerning that, as well as graphics concerning the way the various groups have split off from the church originally founded by Joseph Smith in 1830. And then following John, we'll have two presentations, one by Gene Adams, who will be talking about one of the schismatic groups, the Hedrickites, or the so-called Church of Christ Temple Lot group, headquartered in Independence. And Gene is an independent scholar. I should mention a little bit about John Hamer that's not going to be any good. Okay, that's for the session tomorrow. That's not going to do any good for this session. John is going to be the second presenter after myself. And John, he's an independent historian and map maker, but his greatest role right now, as far as I'm concerned, is not only the co-editor of this volume, but he is also, along with his partner, Mike Karpowitz, the executive director of they're the executive directors of the John Whitmer Historical Association. And I'll just put in a commercial here. We invite you all to come out to Kirtland, Ohio, where our conference for the John Whitmer is going to be held in September. The dates are September 27th through the 30th, the last part of September. And so that's just a little bit about John Hamer. As I say, our second presenter, who is Gene Adams — they didn't put this in the order of presentation, but in alphabetical order — he's from Woodinville, Washington. He's an independent scholar. A researcher, and he's a former chief financial officer with ISSI Business Solutions in Seattle. I can't remember what that is exactly. I guess he could probably explain that. His wife, Elizabeth, and he's always been an avid student of Mormon history. And as I say, he'll be talking about the Temple Lot group. And then our final presenter, who probably doesn't need a long introduction to a lot of you here because you've probably heard her. She's been a regular Sunstone participant, presenter. I think she's presented in about every Sunstone over the last several years. And she is going to be talking about fundamental Mormonism. She was born and raised in the LDS Church, coming from generations of prominent pioneer ancestors. She graduated with honors from Brigham Young University, and she considers herself a fundamentalist Mormon for over 40 years. With her husband, the very prominent, prolific writer Ogden Kraut, they wrote and published a total of 65 books in LDS history and doctrine. And I should mention an excellent book that she has co-edited is Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. There are copies available in the bookstore, free plug for your book. Anyway, those are the participants. Now, I'm going to be giving a brief introductory overview of the dynamics of schism, which is an abridgment of what will be the introduction to the volume itself. And this will give you an idea of the dynamics of schism. So let me just go ahead and give that. A persistent theme within Mormonism has been schism and fragmentation, evident from the earliest days of the Restoration. In 1831, just 1 year following the formation of Joseph Smith's Church of Christ, the Mormon prophet was confronted with the conflicting claims of two rivals, Whitcomb Clark, who formed his own Pure Church of Christ, and John Noah, a self-proclaimed prophet. Even prior to that time, in late 1830, two early church members manifested unorthodox beliefs and practices of their own. The first was Black Pete, an African-American convert who was active among Smith's Kirtland followers as a self-styled revelator or chief man. So, you know, a lot of people are unaware of that the black problem in the LDS church started very, very early. And the second was a woman, interestingly enough. Her name was Laura Hubbell, and she professed to be a prophetess of the Lord, wanting to establish herself as a teacher in the church. So women in the priesthood was out there, you know, very early. Schism continued to plague Smith throughout the 1830s. In 1832, a Mormon by the name of Horton withdrew from the church, rejecting both Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, organizing his own independent church, as it was called. 4 years later, James Colin Brewster, a precocious 10-year-old youth, claimed direct communication with the angel Moroni, proceeding to write his own works of scripture, all of which led to his disfellowship and ultimate excommunication. A more serious threat came in 1837 with the formation of the Church of Christ by Warren Parrish. Parrish, a one-time traveling elder with a reputation as an eloquent preacher, brought into his organization a number of very important dissidents, including three members of the church's Quorum of the Twelve, specifically brothers Luke S. Johnson and Lyman Johnson, along with John F. Boynton. Also joining Parrish's organization following his break with Smith was none other than Martin Harris, one of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Opposition to Joseph Smith's leadership continued at Far West Missouri, where the church established its headquarters during the late 1830s. In addition to more defections from within the Quorum of the Twelve, including William McClellan and Thomas Marsh, Smith was forced to deal with the withdrawal and or excommunication of other important individuals, including Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer, the two remaining of the three witnesses. Two schismatic groups emerged during this difficult period. The Church of Jesus Christ, the Bride and the Lamb's Wife, formed by George M. Hickel, a one-time leader of the Caldwell County Militia, who had negotiated the surrender of the Latter-day Saints at the conclusion of the Missouri Mormon War. A second group was the so-called Alston Church, formed by Isaac Russell as a direct result of the Missouri War, with Russell seeking support from dissident Mormons who desired to remain in Missouri, contrary to Smith's directive to leave. In Nauvoo, the Mormons' new gathering place, dissent and schism continued. In March 1842, Oliver H. Olney was disfellowshipped on charges of setting himself up as a prophet. Also in 1842, Francis Gladden Bishop, asserted his own claims as a self-professed prophet, establishing his own group known as the Kingdom of God. Then 2 years later, however, Smith faced his most serious challenge to leadership, and this was one with very fateful results. It came from a group of dissident Latter-day Saints led by William Law, a wealthy Canadian convert and counselor in the Church First Presidency. William was joined by his brother Wilson, along with a number of other influential Latter-day Saints. This group opposed plural marriage and Smith's involvement in politics, causing them to characterize Smith as, quote, a fallen prophet. These dissidents set up a rival church organization known as the True Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and began publication of the Nauvoo Expositor, their own newspaper. Ultimately, as we're all well aware, Joseph Smith's action in ordering the destruction of the Expositor set the stage for his arrest, imprisonment, and assassination in Carthage Jail in June 1844. Now, the pace of Mormon schism and fragmentation accelerated following Smith's death, with the largest group of Mormons, mainly located in Nauvoo, accepting the leadership of Brigham Young and the Twelve. But a number of rival Latter-day Saint groups emerged during this this period of fragmentation following Smith's death. Among the noteworthy Latter-day Saints opposing the Twelve were members of Smith's own family, specifically his first wife Emma, mother Lucy, and younger brother William, all of whom joined and or affiliated with various rival groups. Other important Mormons asserting rival claims to LDS authority included Sidney Rigdon, a counselor in the Church First Presidency, Lyman White, member of the Quorum of the Twelve, and James J. Strang, a gifted charismatic leader who claimed prophetic powers not unlike those asserted by Joseph Smith himself. This period of fragmentation ended in 1860 with the formation of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints under the leadership of Joseph Smith III. The son of the slain Mormon prophet gathered into his organization a significant portion of the one-time followers of Strang, Lyman White, and Alphaeus Cutler, and other scattered saints. Over time, the Midwestern-based Reorganized Church became the second largest of all Latter-day Saint denominations. But a significant number of Latter-day Saints chose not to follow young Joseph, rejecting his prophetic claims, and in the process formed the basis of two new denominations. The first, the Church of Jesus Christ, was organized in 1862 by William Bickerton, a one-time member of Sidney Rigdon's Schismatic Church of Christ. At present, the Church of Jesus Christ, with its headquarters in Mongahoola, Pennsylvania, is generally recognized as the third largest Latter-day Saint denomination. We're running interference here. Okay. The second organization formed in opposition to Joseph III was the Church of Christ Temple Lot, established under the leadership of Granville Hedrick, with its headquarters in Independence, Missouri. And that's the group that Gene is going to be talking in more detail about. Meanwhile, members of the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, under Brigham Young's leadership, established their church as the largest of all Latter-day Saint denominations. And this was because, in large measure, due to their isolation in the Great Basin. But despite Mormon geographic isolation, well away from Midwestern schismatic activity, Young and his followers were forced to deal with schisms of their own. Two noteworthy schismatic movements were formed during the 1860s. The first, the Church of the Firstborn, was organized by Joseph Morris in 1861. Morris, an English convert, claimed prophetic powers, bringing forth his own revelations. A second organization, the Church of Zion, was formed in 1868 by a group of dissident Mormons under the leadership of William S. Godby, Elias L.T. Harrison, and former Latter-day Saint apostle Amasa Mason Lyman. These so-called Godbyites proclaimed spiritual manifestations and revelations in opposition to the practices and policies promoted by the mainline Mormon Church. Utah Latter-day Saints faced an even greater schismatic challenge during the late 19th and early 20th century, this coming from fundamentalist Mormonism. Fundamentalist Mormonism developed in direct opposition to official Latter-day Saint efforts to phase out plural marriage, commencing with the Manifesto of 1890. And that's going to be the topic of Ann Wild's presentation. Throughout both the 19th and 20th centuries, the number of Latter-day Saint schismatic groups continued to proliferate. The cumulative number of Mormon schismatic groups formed during the period from 1830 right down to the present has been estimated at well over 400. I think that's pretty stark. That's a pretty stark statistic. That tells us something. At present, as of 2007, there is an estimated 80 groups that are active. Such schism resulted in a literal scattering of the Latter-day Saints, both geographically and in terms of doctrines and beliefs. I've found in my research that there are at least four major causes of Mormon schism, and if any of you got ideas of perhaps additional ones, I'll welcome them, but these are the four that I've come up with. Number one obvious factor was Joseph Smith's failure to designate a clear successor, this leading to a succession crisis following his death. That's one major cause. A second major factor involves Mormonism's basic characteristic as an ever-changing, evolving institution. Inherent in Mormonism are certain centrifugal tendencies resulting from the movement's fundamental nature as a dynamically evolving institution. Indeed, the church has both attracted and thrown off a wide divergence of people, each with remarkably differing interpretations of the truths of Mormonism. A third cause of schism is the ambiguous, complex legacy of Joseph Smith himself. The Mormon leader was a, quote, prophet of puzzling complexity, and here I'm quoting his foremost biographer, Richard L. Bushman. A charismatic leader, Smith was always open to a variety of complex and even contradictory systems of thought. Specifically, the Mormon prophet articulated increasingly radical doctrines and practices, often at variance with earlier ones. Smith's complex, contradictory, and increasingly radically doctrinal concepts influenced his would-be successors and others seeking to carry on his legacy. And finally, I have detected a fourth, in some ways, interrelated factor facilitating schism. And this is also embodied, specifically in Joseph Smith himself. Specifically, the Mormon leader as a prophet, and it's very important to keep this in mind, seer and revelator, received and promoted divine revelation and direction all the way through his career. Smith's prophetic powers were, however, a double-edged sword. On the one hand, Smith, in asserting such powers, was able to wield influence, considerable influence over his followers, but at the same time, Smith's establishment of such prophetic precedent inspired certain of his followers to manifest prophetic powers of his own. You can see this in Mormonism from the very beginning. These often leading to dissent and schism. This tradition not only continued, but intensified in the wake of Joseph Smith's sudden and unexpected death, which further complicated by Smith's failure to designate a prophetic successor. Thus, a long list of would-be successors sought to legitimize their own claims to leadership through prophetic powers of their own. In fact, from 1844 down to the present, a significant percentage of Latter-day Saint groups have attributed to their leaders prophetic powers akin to those of Joseph Smith. The Mormon founder's prophetic legacy is clearly manifested in the numerous and wide variety of scattered schismatic groups to emerge over the following 160 years. Now I'm going to turn it over to John, who will outline what's contained in the various essays and give, a PowerPoint demonstration of how the schism unfolded.
If we can get it to work,
yeah, right.
Here it is. Thank you. Hi, guys. Sorry for the technical difficulties and distractions. I've already given out a handout that it has the titles of all the essays and all of the authors, but I thought I'd just give you a... Oh, perfect. Thank you. That's helpful. Just in time. Worked out. Sorry for the distraction. Well, we'll wait for it. I don't need it right now. We'll get in just a second when the computer's off. Okay, the 15 essays in this volume examine various aspects of the scattering of the saints, along with a number of the important diverse groups that resulted from such schism, all of whom trace their roots back to Joseph Smith's original church of Christ, formed in 1830. The first essay in the volume is written by Aaron Jennings, and it outlines the background and activities of the Peter Whitmer family, which, aside from the Joseph Smith family, was undoubtedly the most important family in early Mormonism. But by the late 1830s, the entire Whitmer family had left Smith's church organization, viewing the Mormon leader as a fallen prophet. They continued to believe in Mormonism, eventually reorganizing what a Whitmerite Church of Christ in Richmond, Missouri, which persisted until 1961. In the second essay, H. Michael Marquardt examines David Whitmer in particular. David was one of the Book of Mormon's three witnesses and maintained his belief in that book of Scripture. He was also one of the original elders of Smith's Church of Christ, but he was uncomfortable with later additions to Mormonism. As David aged, he continued to seek a return to his own vision of the primitive restored church and indeed primitive Christianity itself. As his beliefs evolved, David's recollections of the early restoration history changed as well. Kyle Walker's essay follows the path taken by William Smith, the last surviving brother of Joseph. William sought ecclesiastical station, recognition of his position as an apostle and as presiding patriarch, which led him on a schismatic odyssey. And if I can, I just found in the LDS archives a wonderful newspaper that William published, and it has a great song. This is when William had organized his own Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in which he was first president, prophet, seer, revelator, and patriarch over the entire church. And that's his title. And where is William here? Here it is. One sec, I'm sorry. So, the seer William God doth call his brothers to succeed. He welcomes home good Mormons all. He's of the promised seed. We will close. That settles that argument. I'm sorry. Let me open this PowerPoint. I'm sorry that we didn't quite have our technical. Here we go. Sorry about that. affiliating first, this is William Smith, before he had this church, he affiliated first with Brigham and the Twelve. He later recognized James J. Strang as his brother's successor, and he then made this attempt to make his own church organization. And from that position, he temporarily affiliated with groups led by Isaac Sheen in Covington, Kentucky, and also Lyman White in Texas. But when those attempts fell apart, William still held out hope for reinstatement, one in Brigham Young's Council of the Twelve, and then ultimately he rejoined his nephew's reorganized church, and he participated in that church without reinstatement in his offices as apostle or patriarch. A large number of Latter-day Saints spread throughout the Midwest face those questions, as Robin Scott Jensen explains in his essay. Jensen finds that prior to 1844, Mormonism meant different things to different Mormons, and many who had experienced a church led by the founding prophet were not able to find what they valued in the religion in an organization led by the 12 apostles as the first presidency. For many of these Mormons, the prophet James J. Strang, with his 4E plates and his continuing revelations, was an enticing alternative. Vicki Cleverly Speak, in the next essay, catalyzed the paths of Strang's followers after Strang's own martyrdom in 1856. Strang had refused to appoint a successor, asserting that the next prophet, if any, would be appointed by angels, just as he had been and just as Joseph had been. And when angelic appointment did not immediately materialize, many in the rank and file of Strang's church, as well as several key leaders, became attracted to Joseph III, prophet and president of what became the RLDS Church, now Community of Christ. Michael Van Wagenen looks into the plans of Joseph Smith at the end of his life and shows the degree to which the founding prophet considered relocating his church from Nauvoo to what was then the independent Republic of Texas. Although his death prevented Smith from acting on those plans, they were carried through in microcosm by a devoted follower, Lyman White. White was a member of the Council of the Twelve and also the Council of the Fifty, which had been charged by Smith with creating an initial base colony in Texas. White refused to be swayed from that path, a fact that ultimately led to schism between himself and the other members of the Twelve. Oh, sure. Wait, maybe quickly run through some of them so that I don't, because I don't remember who we all have. Here. So here's William, who we just did. Here's James Strang, Joseph III, Sidney Rigdon. This is Charles Thompson, Steve Vesey, David Whitmer, Lyman White. This is Fred Larson, the president of the Remnant Church, Oliver Cowdery, Emma, Brigham Young, and Paul Palmieri, the president of the Church of Jesus Christ with headquarters in Monongahela, Monongahela, Pennsylvania. I know you can't say that word. Okay. Danny Jorgensen tells the history of another Latter-day Saint church that emerged under the leadership of a member of the Council of 50. And this church this is the Church of Christ Temple Lot. This is the church in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. This is the Church of Christ with the Elijah Message, which is another Hedrickite church. And this is the Cutlerite Church, which is to say the Church of Jesus Christ, reorganized under Alphaeus Cutler. Alphaeus Cutler was a senior member of the 50 who had been charged by Smith with taking a mission to the Native Americans. Cutler established that mission in the unorganized territory near winter quarters and refused to abandon it to go further west. Cutler reorganized his Church of Jesus Christ in 1853 in Manti, Iowa. Under his successors, the Cutlerites migrated first to northern Minnesota before ultimately returning to Independence, Missouri, where they are today. Michael S. Riggs follows the Cutlerite migration as a perilous, quote, epic journey, finding that all along the way the group was challenged by the competing organization of the RLDS Church. Riggs proposes that Joseph Smith's dedication of the land of Zion in Missouri and the subsequent expulsion of the early Mormons from Jackson County can be viewed as a diaspora, and he looks at the Cutlerites as a microcosm of the Latter-day Saint diaspora and expected or sometimes realized return to the Holy Land. Larry Watson, church historian for the Church of Jesus Christ with headquarters in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, describes the history of his branch of the Restoration. Watson's group traces its lineage through Sidney Rigdon, the last remaining member of the First Presidency after the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram, and also Joseph's vice presidential running mate. After the disintegration of Rigdon's organization, the church was down to a single man, William Bickerton. Bickerton reorganized the church in 1862, and it has continued to this day, generally recognized, as Mill said, as the third largest Latter-day Saint denomination to have emerged from the 1844 schism. Gene Adams, who's here, describes in his essay another church that emerged from the 1844 secession crisis a group of independent Latter-day Saint branches dating from the 1840s but unaffiliated with any organization, reorganized themselves in 1863 under the leadership of Granville Hedrick. Reassuming the church's original name, the Church of Christ, they were the first Latter-day Saints to return to Jackson County to redeem Zion. After much hardship, members were able to repurchase the original lot in Independence that Joseph had dedicated for building the temple, and now known as the Church of Christ Temple Lot, these saints continue to have their headquarters to this day. However, not all the Latter-day Saints who trace their lineage through Granville Hedrick's leadership are in communion today. Jason R. Smith outlines the history of the many churches that have emerged from the temple lot, including, among others, three identically named Churches of Jesus Christ with the Elijah message, of which I've got a picture of the one. And you have to, they also publish a publication. You have to look at the small print to know which one it is, since they're all there in Independence, including, and then another one is the so-called Basement Church of Pauline Hancock, of which famously Gerald and Sandra Tanner here in Salt Lake City were once members, and then the two churches that built their own Zion in Shell City, Missouri. Returning to us to Utah, Edward Leo Lyman explores the descent of LDS Apostle Amasa Lyman. Lyman, the apostle, parted ways with Brigham Young and initially used the Godbeite Reform Movement to channel his opposition to the LDS Church. Lyman was made president of the Godbeite Church of Zion. When that organization failed, Lyman met with our LDS missionary, David H. Smith, the posthumous son of the prophet, in 1872. Lyman toyed with the idea of affiliating with the RLDS mission in Utah in order to continue his opposition to Young, and he made a proposal to that effect to Joseph III. However, the overture was rejected, most likely due to Lyman's continuing practice of polygamy, among other issues. Ann Wilde, who is here, explains the history of fundamentalist Mormonism. Although the LDS Church phased out the practice of plural marriage slowly after 1890, many Mormons continued to believe in the principle, and Ann shows that the men and women who espouse fundamentalist Mormon beliefs are extremely diverse. Wilde traces the lineage and catalogs the major groups and also discusses independent fundamentalist Mormons. Craig L. Foster, meanwhile, discusses the persistence of the practice of plural marriage within the mainstream LDS Church. Using the example of the Barr and Mary Lance Musser family, Foster shows that a large number of Mormons continue to practice the principle in secret within the LDS Church through the middle of the 20th century. Finally, David Howlett describes the Restoration Branch movement, which emerged from the recent schism within the reorganization tradition over issues including the extension of priesthood ordination to women. Conservative opponents in the RLDS Church to this trend, sometimes labeled as Restorationists or RLDS Fundamentalists, although that gets confusing because of the Mormon fundamentalists here, they have separated from what is now known as the Community of Christ and have begun meeting in independent restoration branches. Hallett explores this movement and discusses how restorationists mark and cross bodily boundaries. In an afterword to the volume, Roger Launius sums up the state of research on the broader Latter-day Saint movement and gives scholars some direction for the future. And I just wanted to quickly, one of the features of the book is going to be, in addition to the 15 articles, about 10 to 15 charts. And these charts are going to go through and catalog some of the expressions of the Latter-day Saint movement. This is an extremely simplified chart. You don't want to see the complicated chart. So if we start this off, I'll just do this, you can't really see it too well. But anyway, we'll start off with the Church of Christ that is existing under Joseph Smith and the six elders that came together in 1830. Quickly, the church has two nucleuses. One of them is operating in Kirtland, Ohio. The other one is operating in Missouri, and they are starting to become a little bit separated, although they're in complete communion. After the bank and all the other issues in 1837, Joseph and Sidney Rigdon come to Missouri, and immediately preceding that, Thomas B. Marsh and other folks are able to drive out the witnesses and the leaders in the Missouri presidency, who essentially, they are here, kind of followed off, leave the body here. And meanwhile, in Kirtland, we were talking about the Parishites and then Gladden Bishop and some of the people that are staying in Kirtland. Again, from when we get to Missouri, after they're in Missouri, we have Hinkle that Newell mentioned being kicked out of this part of it and organizing his own church, getting to Nauvoo, to the time here that is the biggest moment of schism when Joseph dies. Right before Joseph dies, William Law's True Church of the Latter-day Saints Sidney Rigdon, reestablishing, reorganizing the church in Pittsburgh, Brigham Young in the 12, remaining in Nauvoo, James Strang exerting his claim to the mantle, and then moving to Iowa across the plains, Whitmer reorganizing in Missouri, getting in communion with McClellan in Kirtland, kind of bringing those guys together, Cutler, in once they're in the plains, Cutler staying in the plains. Following down that, the Strang and the Prairie Saints, Strang moving first to Boree, going to the island, having his own major groups of dissenters, including William Smith, who is additionally affiliated with him, having his own church, Lyman White. Eventually, a lot of them all being brought together into the former Strangites and all these other groups into the reorganized church, which moves on. Meanwhile, we were talking about the Hedrickites, the Temple Lot, and also here again some of the Cutlerites, and again a remnant of the Strangites, all continuing on until this day. The Hedrickites become the Temple Lot church when they get back to the Temple Lot, and then having their own significant schism more recently in the 20th century, and again the Community of Christ and its schisms. Going back, we had Bickerton eventually coming to the out of the Rigdonite tradition to the Church of Jesus Christ in Monongahela, as we've been talking about. Rigdon having his own, a different church kind of beyond that. David Whitmer reorganizing his Church of Christ. And then, of course, the Godbeites, the Mass Alignment, and then also the Fundamentalist Mormon. And so in each case, there will be a much more detailed chart kind of talking about each chapter, and this is the one that is with Ant's chapter.
So. You deserve applause.
I think the largest number probably is present now. I mean, and I think Newell is suggesting that Steve Seald said to you that there's maybe 80 active congregations that would, or at least, in other words, churches that are organizations that are large enough to have an active congregation. Now, if you were to now expand that out to every, you know, independent individual who is the remnant of a tradition and who still considers themselves to be, you know, an independent expression of the Latter-day Saint movement. I think Ann will even say that there, I mean, the number of independent fundamentalists who, all by themselves, who aren't affiliated with any particular church is going to be enormous, but they don't have a congregation in that way. So maybe it's about 80. So this is a very simplified chart. This is only kind of some of these more major expressions, and that's kind of what we've had to do in this particular book. When Steve Shields' new book, a complete revision of his Divergent Paths of the Restoration, comes out, it's going to list everything. But that's not. This is more of a narrative of the major expressions.
The Church of Christ on the Temple Lot has been an item of great interest to me for some time. And I think it's only fair that I probably answer one of the questions that usually gets asked. How did I ever get into this? My wife, Elizabeth, is a direct descendant of Granville Hedrick. He was her great-great-uncle, her great-great-grandfather, Granville's brother, John Hedrick, as I'll point out here, is the first one back to Missouri and actually is the one that buys the first three of the eight lots to make up the Temple Lot today. In addition to that, her other great-great-grandfather is Richard Hill, who became the third president of their church and led them through a good portion of the Temple Lot suit of the 1890s. Getting information is an extremely difficult task, but with the celebrity status that my wife quickly achieved with William Sheldon and others back in Independence as being the only one that they know of that's a descendant of two of their past leaders, things did open up a little bit, and I went from doing more of a family history gathering to a real serious pursuit of that aspect of Mormon history. They are an interesting group. They have survived in spite of themselves and in spite of others. They have had a very interesting past, and it was alluded to just briefly by John. Their beginnings, actually, and their basis is that they are the original church established by Joseph Smith. In the aftermath of the days following the dispersion of saints in and out of the areas around Nauvoo, in central Illinois, there were four independent branches of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that stayed there, literally unaffected by everything else that was going on 135 miles to the west. They were not persecuted, nor were they driven out. Some of them eventually followed after Brigham, but most stayed. An interesting side note is that this is where several of these people were actually converted to Mormonism in the 1830s and had already experienced the Missouri period, and instead of settling in and around Nauvoo and Quincy and those areas, they actually went back and repurchased farmlands that they'd once sold, or at least in the same area, in and around Bloomington, Illinois. So it was kind of going home to them in many sense. There were four active branches. In the 1850s, of their own volition, they kind of merged together. This would be the middle 1850s, into the Church of Jesus Christ, parentheses, capitalized O, of Latter-day Saints. And they just continued to function. The leaders of these groups and then the consolidated group were all originally ordained elders in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then as more and more information came out regarding Brigham Young and polygamy, they distanced themselves from that and at the same time made efforts beginning as early as the early 1850s to talk with those early leaders of the new organization that became the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ. My paper, my essay deals with some of the efforts to get together and see if they could consolidate feelings, but the bottom line was, is I think lineal priesthood was the dividing line, in spite of the fact that over their life, they tried to get together on at least four or five other occasions to consolidate their differences and perhaps even merge. How they got to independence, of course, is the main focus. From these early branches, Johnny Page emerges. He joins with Granville Hedrick, who has now become the self-appointed leader of the group. When John Page joins, he brings with them the apostolic priesthood. And as a result of that, he ordains Hedrick, three others, and as apostles, and with himself constitute a quorum of five apostles. And subsequently, in 1863, he ordains Granville Hedrick as prophet, seer, revelator, and translator of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They changed their name during this period to the Church of Christ. Soon after Granville Hedrick became the ordained president and prophet of their church, in 1864 he received a revelation delivered by an angel. And in this revelation he was commanded to take his saints back to Independence, Missouri, in specifically the year 1867, and redeem Zion and reclaim the temple lot in the center place of Zion. He does go on with a period of about 2 years, but his brother John, this being my wife's great-great-grandfather, is actually the vanguard leader. He goes back in 1865, which frankly was a dangerous thing to do. The Civil War had been only over just a very few months when he returned to Independence, Missouri, and purchased a farm in the Independence vicinity. This became the launch spot. Later, John Clark and Jedediah Owen returned in 1866. They also buy farms close to Independence. And then in the January-February period of 1867, some 6 to 10 families actually leave their farms in central Illinois, and they make a winter overland covered wagon trek to Independence and there initiate their stake in reclaiming Zion. The first temple lots are purchased by John Hedrick out of his own money. In 1867, he purchases three of 8 lots. He deeds these in 1869 to Granville Hedrick as trustee and trust for the church. Interestingly, side note, Granville Hedrick does not come with any of these original groups. I have done some extensive research in Illinois. I'm still going to do some more this fall. But it looks like Hedrick does not even make an attempt to come until 1869 or perhaps even early 1870, at which point he doesn't even stay and he moves to Johnson County, Kansas, buys a large piece of land and sets up his family on that land, and then just on occasion comes back and forth to Independence, although he's still considered their prophet and president. In the 1870s, 73 and 74, another early leader, William Eaton, who was part of the original Crow Creek branch, he emerges and he buys up over the next 2 years the remaining five lots, making eight in total, putting together the contiguous eight lots that they own today, and which is referred to as the Temple Lot. Lot number 15 being the historic or most related spot as to where Joseph Smith actually stood when he dedicated the land in his first trip to Missouri. He also turns over his properties to Granville Hedrick as trustee and trust 2 or 3 years later. The last little piece of that property is actually given for the large sum of $75, not given, purchased for $75 in 1907 to Richard Hill, my wife's other great-great-grandfather. That was a little corner piece on the north side, which was abandoned as a street by the City of Independence and basically sold for $75, like I said, to put together what they really have now is 2 3/4 acres of the land, and have built in succession three churches on that property. The first one in 1889, which was in part maybe to further frustrate their neighbors across the street, the reorganized church, who had already initiated legal action in 1887 to take over the property. Instead of acquiescing, they went ahead and built a church. That church was burned down in 98 by an arsonist, a member of their congregation that was deranged. That building stood until 1990, and it was burned down by another arsonist, another member of their church. And an individual who also belonged to several other of the restoration churches, I might also add. And then that building that stands on their lot today is the new building. And they continue to operate out of that facility as their headquarters. How am I doing on time? I'm just kind of close. Okay, let me just see if I want to make any particular... one of the other things I mentioned briefly is their struggles. It wasn't just getting there and claiming the land, but it was keeping it. And the first major struggle is the Temple Lot case itself. That starts in 87. It really gets kicked into gear in 1891 when the reorganized church files a lawsuit in the U.S. Circuit Court. We call it a district court today. That ends up being in favor of the RLDS Church in 94, quickly appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. It's overturned in 95. It goes to the U.S. Supreme Court in 96. They refuse to hear the court. It's remanded back to the U.S. Court of Appeals. Everything's back to square one, only it's cost $7,600 of hard-earned money on the part of the Church of Christ Temple Lot to defend themselves, and we're talking about a group that had a population base of somewhere around 75 to 100 people, and they were fighting Goliath, who had a population base of somewhere in that period of time 35 to 40,000. Efforts, in spite of all that, were made to try to merge, and I cover that in my essay, bringing them up to date to the 1917-1918 period, where the two groups actually sign up articles of agreement. Working harmony is what it was called. Over that period of about 10 years, about 3,000 members of the Church of the of Jesus Christ of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they transfer their membership, which was allowed during this period of time. Out of that group comes the 11 of their first 12 apostles. This, among other things, doesn't set well with Frederick Smith and those in charge. This leads to a termination of that agreement. And right after that, we have one of their apostles who had been an early second-level leader in their church out of Michigan, Otto Fetting. Otto Fetting comes as a member of the apostles. He receives in 1927, he receives a visit from an angelic messenger who later identifies himself as John the Baptist and delivers a series of messages. The fifth message, delivered in 1928, commands them to begin building the temple in 1929. They have a groundbreaking ceremony in 1929 at the temple lot. The building's to be 90 feet by 180 feet. They don't literally get off the ground. That's kind of a bad pun there. And they have problems with Otto Fetting. Otto Fetting then becomes the first schism of their church. By the fall of 29, he is silenced because he's now advocating rebaptism, which was according to message number 12. And as a result of that, by April conference of 1930, he's excommunicated. And later, a few years later, all of his revelations, all of his messages are disputed and cast aside by the Church of Christ. But now extensive damage is done. The temple lot excavation is underway. Getting funds becomes extremely difficult. He leads 1,400, or about one-third of the membership of the church, away with him. And they struggle through the Depression on top of all the other things. Finally, they fill in the hole in 1946, and that's what you see today. If you look at that lot carefully on your next visit back to Independence, you can actually see that the land kind of slopes down just a little bit. The fill-in wasn't quite as equal to the original land that was there, and they have little cornerstones that mark those four spots that are out in that beautiful piece of ground. Today, they have finally moved forward with a significant missionary effort. Their greatest successes have been in Uganda, Tanzania, and Africa, where they have about 3,000 members, and about the same number of members in the Philippines, which is their second area of great success. They have today a total population of somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000, about 1,000 in the United States, half of that in Missouri, scattered among seven congregations, the largest of which meets in the temple lot building and their headquarters for their church in Independence. That's a quick sketch and view. Did I cover that okay?
Yeah, great.
Okay. And afterwards, probably we'll take questions. Okay.
Yep.
I'm impressed. I thought that was wonderful. Hardly a note. I could have done that had I spent a little more time getting ready. But I'm really glad to have been invited to be a part of this book for representing Fundamentalist Mormons, also to be a part of this panel today. I think probably like nearly all of the schismatics that he has talked about already, each one of them thinks that they are the true group, the true authority. Fundamentalists are no exception. However, looking at those little circles up there, the way we look at it is that first circle just can ride on through, and that's what the Fundamentalist Mormons are believing. That's naturally our biased opinion, but I've been an independent Fundamentalist Mormon for, like you said, about 40 years. I very much value my background and membership in the church as long as I had it. However, I felt like with my husband doing all this research on the books that we did, I realized there had been a lot of changes made in the LDS church mainstream, and I decided that there was a big difference between the gospel and the church. And in my way of thinking, the eternal principles of the gospel cannot change. The church can accept or reject or change them. They have the right to do that. But starting out, the chapter title is pretty close. I don't know how they put it in the book, but I believe it's Fundamentalist Mormonism, Its History, Diversity, and Stereotypes. Just so that we're all on the same page, let's define Fundamentalist Mormon. Fundamentalist, I probably better use my glasses here. I'm getting older. Fundamentalist Mormon is the preferred umbrella term applied to all those who believe in the early or fundamental doctrines of Mormonism as taught by Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and John Taylor. These doctrines were adhered to by the general membership of the mainstream LDS Church until the latter part of the 19th century. By then, the mainstream LDS Church leaders and members began rejecting and denying and changing them in order to become more accepted by the larger non-Mormon society. I might mention here that naturally polygamy is the most obvious of the changes that were made beginning in 1890 when the church issued the manifesto. That was not the only change right away. Right in that decade of 1890s, they also discontinued the United Order. They changed the Kingdom of God, the definition of it. Today it's the same thing as the church. So plural marriage is the thing that we'll talk about the most because that's the most conspicuous doctrine, but that is by no means the only definition or only doctrine or practice of a fundamentalist Mormon. Some of the other ones, like I mentioned, the United Order, Rebaptism Gathering. My husband and I wrote a book called 95 Theses, and we went through and explained 95 different changes that have been made in the doctrines of the church through the years. Fundamentalist Mormons believe that the LDS Church as an institution has the right to accept or reject fundamental gospel principles. However, we as fundamentalist Mormons believe that rejection by the institution does not make the principles any less true or eternal. Given that, the definition of the word fundamental is, by the dictionary, is essential, primary, original, chief, and most important. Therefore, fundamentalist Mormons question, how is it possible for a fundamentalist, for a fundamental and eternal gospel doctrine or ordinance to be changed? That's why we make the distinction between the church and the gospel. Although fundamentalist Mormons profess a belief in the doctrine of plural marriage, fewer than 50% of those people actually practice it. The term Mormon originated as a nickname given by outsiders to Joseph Smith's followers in the early days of the Latter-day Saint Church. Since that time, the term has been used in a variety of contexts. Liberal Mormons, feminist Mormons, orthodox, anti-Jack. Why can't we be fundamentalist Mormons? Because that defines what we are. And really, I like Michael Quinn's explanation of when he was excommunicated from the church, he called himself a DNA Mormon, and I think that's what we consider ourselves to be too, because we do have a lot in common still with the LDS Church. Just briefly, a little of the history, and this is all very brief. If you need more details, you have to read the essay. Mainstream Mormons and fundamentalist Mormons share a common early heritage. Many of our ancestors lived and defended the principle of plural marriage as essential to achieving the highest degree of exaltation in the celestial kingdom. Joseph Smith is reported by his scribe, William Clayton, to have emphasized the importance of living this eternal law. From him, quote, "From him, Joseph Smith, I learned that the doctrine of plural and celestial marriage is the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to man on the earth, and that without obedience to that principle, no man can ever attain to the fullness of exaltation in celestial glory." However, it wasn't long after Joseph Smith, well, it was 50 years after Joseph Smith made that statement that the church began to make changes. In 1890, of course, was the first manifesto. 1904 was the second one issued by Joseph F. Smith. 1933 was the third manifesto by Heber J. Grant. Then 2 years after that, in 1935, the state of Utah voted to have plural marriage to be considered as a felony instead of a misdemeanor. We're one of the only states in the United States that considers cohabitation or polygamy to be a felony. and we're, as Principal Voices, a group that I helped start, we're trying to get that changed eventually. It's a long-term goal. And, of course, today, people found to be living plural marriage are excommunicated from the mainstream church. Going back to 1886, which is the date that they used on the chart, that really is where fundamentalist Mormons probably started. However, it doesn't mean that we set up any new doctrines at that time. It was the year that John Taylor, the third president, received a revelation that fundamentalist Mormons place a lot of credence in. And just as a review, that was where the Lord appeared to John Taylor and said that how could he revoke an eternal, everlasting principle? It was, and then it was be up to the free agency of the people regarding the living of that lifestyle. So in 1886, along with this revelation right after that, John Taylor called six other men, making a quorum of seven, to keep this principle alive. And so over the next few years, up until about 1928, these men, as they died off, they kept on keeping that principle alive until they died. Then in 1928, John Woolley died and left his son, Lorne Woolley, as the last surviving member of that original council. So in 1930, between 1928 and 1934, he called six other men to be successors and fill up the vacancies in that quorum. He died in 1934. That left Leslie Broadbent as the chief of, or the senior member of that priesthood council. He was there until 6 months later when he passed away, and then John Y. Barlow became the leading senior member of the council. It was during John Y. Barlow's tenure that there began to be some differences of opinion between him and Joseph Musser. John Y. Barlow wanted to establish a united order down in Short Creek, which was a community that had already been pretty well established. Joseph Musser did not like that idea, and there were some other differences. So at that time, there began to be a division in the main priesthood council with John Y. Barlow and that council, which eventually became FLDS, as we know it today, down in Colorado City Hilldale, and then Musser appointed Rulon Allred, Owen Allred, and his brother Marvin, and some other men to start a second council. Only one didn't recognize the other. So that's kind of the beginning of the two major groups that we know today. Let's see. So at this point, I'm going to kind of leave my notes. I don't know if you can see this, but maybe you can get an idea. I need to still talk in this microphone, I guess. 2 years ago, I was asked to make a presentation down in St. George. With the attorney generals from both states, Arizona and Utah, and in giving that presentation, I thought, you know, we have never seen or heard accurate numbers of the groups of the fundamentalists. So I have become very familiar with the leaders of all the groups except for FLDS. They're pretty isolated down there. And the members of some of the priesthood quorums. And so I talked to many of them, and all of them, except FLDS, to get a more accurate count of how many fundamentalist Mormons there really are. So in starting with the largest, the independent fundamentalist Mormons, and I'll just tell you a little bit about those as we go along. It won't take long. The independents are those who do not belong to an organized group. They recognize the man or the husband as the patriarch of the family. He has the priesthood. He has the authority to baptize, to bless his children, whatever ordinances need to be done in that family. My husband, Ogden Kraut, for example, got his authority from Joseph Musser, and then it was traced on back. It's a very short line of authority to John Taylor. And I saw evidences of the priesthood that he held, and that was outside the church. That's our belief. So the independents are about 15,000, and that's a very hard number to come up to, excuse me, to come up with, because they, since they don't have an organization, there are no records kept, but we had so many thousands of people come into our home and discuss the books that my husband had written, and then we know these huge families, Kelches, Barlows, Bosses, they're just a lot of huge families that have never joined any of the groups, or maybe they did for a while and then they came back out of them. So based on my personal experience, really, I came up with the 15,000 figure, and I still feel after 2 years that this is very as accurate as we can get. This chart was updated. Like I say, I originally did it 2 years ago. I updated it just for this presentation to see what the numbers were now. They're pretty much the same, except for one exception, and I'll discuss that next. In the FLDS community, I'm sure you've all heard about them in the news, and that's the group led by Warren Jeffs. It's been interesting for me to find out that over the past 2 years, well, really 5 years, there have been 100 of what they term lost boys that have left that community. And a lot of them are girls. Some of them are families as well. So then you, well, the 1,000 young people that have left. Then there have been 1,000 approximately of the other families or so forth, individuals that have left. So initially, they were about 10,000 people as far as we could find out. And that's a pretty hard figure to arrive at as well. But since they have 2,000 now that have left, I would, and I've talked to Brooke Adams from the Tribune, who's a reporter on polygamy issues, and she agreed. In fact, she thinks 8,000 is now a little high. But as far as we can come up with, there's approximately 8,000 that still have some kind of allegiance to Warren Jeffs and that community. The 2,000, the only way I know how to term them is former LDS. Some of them have still have the same basic beliefs and are considered fundamentalist Mormons. Some of them at this point, like the teenagers that have left, they really don't want much to do with it right now. So they're just kind of in limbo, and I don't really know how to classify them. But I think basically those beliefs are still ingrained in them as a fundamentalist Mormon. The well, let's see. I'll go to the Centennial Park group next, because they have about 1,500. In 1984, there was a split in the council again. There were two people, Marion Hammond and Del Timpson, who did not go along with some of the authority issues in FLDS. Now, the FLDS Church was not organized legally until 1991. But before that, in 1984, two of these men that I mentioned were asked to leave because they didn't support the initial priesthood council. So they started Centennial Park. They have a community about 2 miles south of Colorado City, Hilldale. And they now have a priesthood council, which is what they wanted all along. They didn't like the one-man rule that FLDS was promoting. Marion Hammond died. Del Timpson became senior member. There were other leaders on the council, but somehow John Timpson, who was Del Timpson's son, kind of went around the senior members, and he became the senior member on the death of his father. And so he is now, John Timpson is a leader of that group. Then going to one of the smaller groups, I'm going to kind of go down the chain here. Nelson, Ivan Nelson and Frank Naylor decided even the Centennial Park priesthood was too controlling, and so they broke away from that group. Most of them moved their families up here to Salt Lake. They have a community of about 300 with headquarters out in Bluffdale. Okay, let's go to the second largest fundamentalist group, and that's the All Red group. This is FLDS, this is AUB, Apostolic United Brethren. They have about 7,500 people, and that was a group that was started, like I mentioned, by Joseph Musser when he called Rulon Allred and some of the other brethren. When Rulon was killed by two members of a rival group from Mexico, his younger brother Owen became senior member of the council, and then when he died in 2 or 3 years ago, then Lemoyne Jensen is now the leader of that group, and they have a council as well. I could tell you a lot about these groups, but in order to find that out, you have to read the book, I guess. Okay, another group that I'm sure most of you have heard of is called the Kingston Group. They prefer to be called Davis County Co-op. They were started in the Great Depression. They decided that families could work together better in supporting themselves economically. They do have fundamentalist Mormon. You can trace them down through that. But they have 1,500 people, and they are now led by Paul Kingston, and they have a council of sorts. They also really value education, as does Centennial Park. I'm amazed at the education emphasis that they put on their people in these communities, and they really value that. We had a youth and family rally last August, and 15 young people participated and volunteered. And one of the girls, for example, was 16 years old, had graduated from high school, and was working on her college degree already. This is just one isolated example, but it's repeated many times over. Then there's a lot of smaller groups, and I won't go into that in detail, but I could mention that you might have heard of Alex Joseph. He had a community down in Page, Arizona. The people there now, since Alex's death, don't even like to be considered fundamentalist Mormons, really. Excuse me, they are more just a civic community that celebrates certain holidays from time to time that were started by Alex Joseph. Another one is the Jim Harmston one in Manti, and we don't even like to mention him in the same breath because they've really taken some different paths than we have. The same with some other people. I'm only mentioning those that I think you've heard of. Tom Green, I know him very well. I was glad to see that he finally got out of jail. He really needed to go back to his family of 20-some-odd kids, and he's got four wonderful wives, and I just hope he takes care of the issues and is a good boy. In fact, we have done so many media interviews. I helped start Principal Voices, which is an advocacy group for this lifestyle, and we have been very, very careful, the media that we've talked to, because we do not want to get in the same position as Tom did. I turned down probably, well, not quite as many as I accept, but I feel like we have a message to get out, and we are glad for an opportunity to tell people that we are very diverse. We're very... we have high standards. The stereotypes are not true. We do not have forced most of us, I can say, because I can't speak for FLDS, but most of us, the rest of us, do not have forced marriages, underage marriages. We're not abusing the welfare system. And keep in mind that this FLDS group now is less than one quarter of the total population of fundamentalist Mormons, which is about 37,000. They should not speak for us, just like any of one group should not speak for the rest of us. But anyway, in closing, because I know my time is up, whatever society's perceptions may be, plural marriage among fundamentalist Mormons seems destined to continue. As University of Utah psychology professor Irwin Altman stated, quote, they, the fundamentalist Mormons, are growing in numbers through eternal birth rates and conversions, and they adhere to a way of life and underlying religious principles that seem to sustain them in the face of societal antipathy to their lifestyle. The practice of plural marriage in the context of religious values is one more of the diverse forms of family structures in modern America. End of quote. The plural marriage system of the Bible and of Joseph Smith still endures among a growing minority, fundamentalist Mormons who cherish and preserve these marriage ideals. Despite scorn and rejection from the mainstream Mormon community and many other Americans, and despite government proceedings against them, fundamentalists continue to display a tenacity and a deep commitment to their beliefs in the face of tremendous opposition, as did their 19th century counterparts. Over the long haul, actions against fundamentalist Mormons seem to have invigorated the community and vindicated their conviction that God's chosen people will always be persecuted. Patterns of history suggest that fundamentalist Mormon polygamy is here to stay, whatever the cost. Thank you very much.
Uh, We've got about 10-12 minutes left, and I would like to open this up for questions. And I would ask you to come forward to the microphone, because they didn't put a microphone out here, and use this microphone up here at the podium. So go ahead.
My question's for Ann. Given the fact that you've described the independents as being devoid of some form of hierarchy except for that which exists within each family unit, what is to keep the doctrine or the theology pure so that there's, for example, the patriarch of the family found a fascination in Madonna and started reading Kabbalah and wanted to incorporate that into your Mormon thinking. What's to stop him from doing that?
That's one thing I consider one of the greatest gifts of God, free agency. And if somebody is an independent fundamentalist Mormon wants to go off and do something else, they certainly have the choice to do that. However, I feel like the scripture says in the 85th section of the Doctrine and Covenants that the house of God is out of order. And I'm not saying the fundamentalists are in order. I mean, you think of scattering of saints. The fundamentalist community is scattered. I mean, there's no question about that. The main difference is among the groups is the claims of authority and their organization. And independents do not want to recognize another man between us and God at this point, because if things are out of order, I don't look to another man. When I have faith in Christ and faith in God, I feel like I don't have to go to another man to get permission to do something. I can go to the Lord and get inspiration. And I realize this is not the ideal. I would much rather have, and I don't want to offend anybody here, but I don't feel like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is totally in order. I feel like there's a lot of things that are out of order. And until that's set in order, we have to do the best we can.
Okay, I'm a non-Mormon, and I study a lot of different groups, so Mormonism is not the only group I study, so I've sort of lost track of a few things. But I've always been curious about the Temple Lot group. Now, from my perspective, I would think that is it 1832 the prophecy he gave? Was it 1836? I keep forgetting when he was prophesying over the land. Now, I would think since the church doesn't really control that and they can't build a temple on it, it sort of helps to negate his prophetic office. That would be my question. Does that interfere with the Utah church's views of Joseph as a prophet? And then I got a second question. You want me to take the second question too? Now, I've heard through the years that I call it the Utah church, that they have offered an exorbitant amount of money over the years to purchase the property so they could perhaps fulfill the prophecy of Joseph Smith. And is that true? And also, perhaps, when is the last time they've offered the Temple Lot group?
Okay, I can answer that pretty quickly, I think. The first question has to do with the sacred space of the spot to build a temple that Joseph Smith dedicated in August of 1831. That was part of 63 acres that Edward Partridge had purchased for the church in December and of 1831. And a wider perspective is that all of that 63 acres is sacred land, and it was certainly the position, and Ron can correct me here if I'm wrong, but with the reorganized church before it became the Community of Christ, they moved towards finally not being able to work out any kind of a merger or reconciliation or whatever with the Church of Christ. They eventually had property right across the street that was all part of the 63 acres, and that's where they've built their lovely temple today. That's a quick and simple answer. The LDS Church began purchasing property in 1904. They have about 26 acres of the original 63 acres. That's where they currently have their visitor center today. And to tie in the rest part of that question is that there have been rumors from clear back in the 1890s up to a more recent period of time. I have never found anything
authentic in terms of an offer ever being made. I've seen plenty of comments made by individuals within the Church of Christ, and then also in Salt Lake City newspapers denying that any such rumor had any merit to it other than just being a rumor, and it seems to resurface every once in a while. So to answer your third part of your question was, I don't know when the last time was, you know. The general answer that you'll get from any of the apostles at the Church of Christ Temple Lot, it's not for sale for any price. So you might as well offer a postage stamp as $1 million. It's not going to do you any good. And that's been told me directly. Yes?
Your answer to the first question. But since a temple has never been built, I mean, the church is not a temple. So does that somehow negate Smith's prophetic office?
No, they fully believe in that, as do almost any of the restoration groups that are still in existence today, that's sacred land, and someday there's going to be a temple built there. Yes and no. The answer yes caused the Church of Christ any sort of problems because they were really concerned about getting it done in the period following the dedication of that spot in 1929. I think just broader interpretations of generation now have justified the position that any of the churches would take. That it doesn't really mean the living descendants, or it doesn't really mean 100 years. It's a broader definition of generation. As far as building the temple there, on that spot, the LDS Church doesn't really make a specific statement today, but I'm sure they would like to build a temple on that spot at some point in time. But the answer from the Church of Christ would be is that at some point in time, the Lord's going to give them specific direction as to whom is going to build that spot. Are they going to work together with somebody to build that spot? Or is the Lord going to make all the things available to them so that they can, once again, redig that hole in the ground and build a temple there? But as being a priority in the church, quoting Apostle Sheldon, that is not a priority in the church today. It's virtually not even discussed today. And not exactly a total answer to your question, but maybe the best we can do at the time.
Just a brief question that Newell can probably answer. I missed what year you said that the Sidney Rigdon schism ended, because when my dad was in the Army in the early 1960s, he actually had a guy that claimed he was a member of a Sidney Rigdon church. So I'm just wondering, is that the same one that Rigdon actually started, or a separate thing?
Well, I don't know if I can answer your question directly, but I give you a little bit of more detail. I mean, Sidney Rigdon was actually involved with two movements personally. There was his original Church of Christ, which was formed directly after the martyrdom, after Joseph Smith's death, established in late 44. And that didn't last very long, because Sidney Rigdon was he didn't have the greatest leadership skills. He was mentally unstable, and that movement quickly disintegrated. And I think that's where Granville Hedrick came out of that first. He came out of this. William Bickerton came out of that group, I believe. Yeah, I'm sorry. And then there was a second group that was formed in the 1850s, and it had a more complicated. I can't recall the exact name, but it had a slightly different name. It was another LDS group, and that one existed up until the time of Sidney, even past Sidney Rigdon's death into the 1870s. And in the meanwhile, you've got the Bickertonite group, which emerges in the late 1850s, and I'm reasonably sure that comes out of the first of those schisms. So, you know, Rigdon was involved, or, you know, or implicated in three different groups. I don't know if that really answers your question, Ryan, but that's the best I can elucidate.
I would just say that anybody you met who probably traces their origin of their belief through Sidney Rigdon, probably will have met in your lifetime that traces their line through Sidney Rigdon is almost certainly going to have been a member of the Church of Jesus Christ, with the headquarters in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. They don't like to say they don't like to use the term phrase Bickertonite, but anyway, so they say the Church of Jesus Christ. If you go to thechurchofjesuschrist.org, That's their website.
My question is for Ann. Have you had access to any of the U.S. Census records to help you put together your chart up here, or maybe the records of the organizations themselves where you could go in and just count the names of the people, or maybe do a door-to-door survey or something like that?
You're talking about a very secretive community. all the groups don't like to have numbers published or out, but they did give me permission to do that. The reason they are only giving estimates, too, because they don't keep records. The All Red group, they don't keep, oh, so-and-so was married on such-and-such a day. And that's on purpose because of the raids that they had, the government raids in 35, 44, and 53. They don't want the government coming in and finding anything in writing. So it's very difficult to have any records where the leader of that group, like Lemoyne Jensen, can say, oh, there's some. But I did talk to a member of the council, and when Owen was alive, I talked to him, and he said there's probably about 5,000. When I did the survey 2 years ago, the council member, Dave Watson, who is a representative for their community, said there were 7,500. I talked to him again, and he says it's probably still about the same. Might have gone up a few hundred, but just to leave it the way it is. About a census, I talked to Brooke Adams, and she saw a preliminary census of 2006 for the Twin Cities area down Utah, Colorado, or Arizona border. She said in those two Twin Cities, it was 6,500. However, I reminded her there's a lot of people that live in those two communities that do not belong to that the religious part of it. They belong to Centennial Park. So they might live there because their houses were there before the split and they don't want to move, but they go to meetings over in Centennial Park. But you've also got communities like El Dorado, Texas, Poncho, Pringle, North South Dakota, you know, little satellite areas, and then you've got Bountiful. That's another community I didn't mention on here. They had about 800 people, and they split in about 2002. 400 of them stayed with Warren Jess, 400 of them went with Winston Blackmore. So you just have to get approximate figures, and the census of 6,500, and then you add these others. We just came up with a very top amount of 8,000 at this time for FLDS.
Mark, go ahead.
Another question for Ann. Could you just talk about the developments over the last few years with the Manti group and the main differences between most fundamentalist Mormons and the Manti group?
I'm not here to be critical of any group. I knew Jim Harmston years ago. I went to some of their study groups before they formed a church. They had a lot of fine people down there, but I have not had anything to do with them in the last several years because what I've heard of some of the claims, some of their practices, claiming it's a plural marriage type thing, I do not go along with some of those practices, but I would rather not specify what they are. It's just that they've taken a different direction than what most of the fundamentalist Mormons believe in. I don't know how else to answer that because I don't want to be critical of anyone else. We're trying to be tolerant of other people just like we hope other people be tolerant of us. And that's one of the messages we try to get out is that we would like to have equal civil rights just like other minorities. Let religion out of it. We don't have equal civil rights. Somebody that's a polygamist can have a job and he can be let go just because he has more than one wife. They can rent a house and the landlord find out he's got more than one wife and they can be evicted. And not because maybe it's the fear of the fact that they've got people in their rental that are, if they're taken to court, are felons. So I just don't feel like that's right. So I think the equal civil rights thing is one of the messages we're trying to get out there.
We've got time for one more question. Kent, go ahead.
We've talked a lot today about schisms. Have there been any significant reunification accomplishments in any of the branches of the restoration?
That's a good question. John, you want to tackle that one?
I was going to suggest that the reorganization itself was a pretty elaborate success story in terms of bringing together a lot of the members of the different churches that had emerged from the 1844 schism. So a huge proportion of Lyman White's followers, William Smith's followers, James Strang's followers, even the Cutler, the vast proportion of the Cutlerites you meet, Thompson's. So a lot. So I would say that that's probably been the most successful one of those? Church of Christ. So then there was just a lot of people who had been, who had really, I mean, and the LDS Church too, so people were going back across the plains. So in that case, I'd probably say that's probably the most successful one, but there have been other mergers too. I just think of what...
I can't think of that very well. Yeah, the only thing that he maybe came close and did was the 1918 Articles of Working Harmony, which almost put the church...
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he was... Go ahead.
The only other really successful movement where two independent groups actually tried to come together, as far as I know, was the 1918 accord between the Community of Christ, then RLDS, and the Church of Christ, which also, just for your information, put Temple Lot in parentheses, and it's really not officially part of the name of their church. That was an effort to put the two churches together, pretty much. They really only left two major things unresolved. One was ownership of the temple lot, which they agreed by one of the articles to, that was not going to change. It was still going to be held by the temple lot group. And the second one was the definition of who the one mighty and strong was. There might be a couple other minor points, but those two they particularly left in kind of an abeyance so that they could work this program together. And while this particular essay doesn't cover it, for 10 years, these two organizations used each other's churches, they used each other's baptismal fonts, they preached at each other's services, they spoke at each other's conferences and did a lot of very good things that would almost put it together. Didn't quite.
And then Fred Smith came along, right? but I'll let others take on that. Well, we've run out of time. I just want to thank all of you for coming, for the questions, and I really want to thank our panelists for, I think, really an excellent session. Thank you.